Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is Bison and Bourbon's chef, Cindy Stanimirov. Bison and Bourbon is an unusual and new concept in the kosher market among kosher restaurants. And let's face it, one of the main things that makes it unique, one of the main things that makes it great is the chef. That's why this evening we are speaking to the chef, Cindy. Good evening, Cindy.
Good evening, and hello, everybody.
So tell us, Cindy, who is the person behind the name? How did a nice girl like you decide to be a chef?
Started off at a very, very young age. I couldn't help myself, but always find myself in the kitchen with my mother making Sunday dinner for the family to get together. And it kind of all started there. My mom, my grandmother were big inspirations for me getting into cooking. And I kind of took it from there, decided that I wanted to pursue my education at a technical high school instead of like a traditional high school so that I can start learning the trade of culinary and start developing my skills at the age of 14 and kind of just progressed from there. I fell in love with it, graduated top of my class, competed in a couple of state and national competitions at a young age, and then moved on to Johnson & Wales in North Carolina, where I studied for 2 years, getting my associate's degree and working full-time. I think that was a huge on me getting into the culinary scene at a young age and progressing to an executive chef title at the age of 27. I think that working full-time while going to school full-time and really honing what I'm learning in school in a real kitchen at the same time really helped catapult me to the position that I'm at now at Bison & Bourbon.
Having eaten at Bison & Burger, it became quite obvious that you have experience in more than one cuisine. You certainly know more than just what is kosher. What were some of the influences in your cooking philosophy?
So definitely any restaurant that I've worked in has been type of like a fusion where you have a little bit of each cuisine, American regional, and it kind of gives the guest the opportunity to taste a little bit of French, a little bit of Italian, a little bit of Asian, a little bit of South American, and then traditional regional cuisines, you know, throughout the United States, whether you're putting a traditional surf and turf, you know, there would be New England or, you know, Southern fried chicken, obviously, from the South. And so kind of taking all of those little bits of things that I've learned in a couple of restaurants that I've been in, I've really worked mainly in four restaurants before coming to Bison & Bourbon, but I had a lot of longevity at those restaurants. So it was learning and developing flavors and dishes from the beginning up until, you know, they were going out to the guests. And that kind of influenced me when I came here to Bison & Bourbon, you know, creating everything from scratch, you know, working off of things that I've done before, putting new twists on them. Obviously, for the kosher aspect, some things had to change. But that was a great challenge to have. That was all a part of the fun with opening up Bison & Bourbon.
Now, considering that you did not come from a background where kosher was a norm, and considering that kosher places certain limitations, in fact, a high number of limitations on cooking, was it easy for you? Was it something that you understood right away? Or was it one of those things, this may not be easy, but it's a challenge I'm going to take?
Definitely the last one. It was not easy, but it was a challenge that I really wanted to accept. I had learned a little bit about kosher before I even came to interview at the restaurant here. Obviously did some research so that I knew what I would be talking about when I interviewed with the owners. And it was definitely a little bit of a shocker, realizing that I couldn't use meat and dairy together, realizing that I would have to find substitutions that I may not have ever worked with before. As a chef, you know, margarine is not something that, you know, it's not the first thing that we grab. We grab butter. You know, grabbing tofu-based non-dairy sour cream is not the first thing we go for. We go for the regular dairy sour cream. And so learning that I wouldn't be able to do that or even put meat and fish on the same plate was a little bit of a challenge. But it was an interesting challenge. It was a fun challenge. And truth be told, it took a long time to get used to it. I would say probably the first 6 months of us being an open restaurant, it was difficult. It was trialing. You know, I find now that I meet guests that come into the dining room, and I talk with them and see how they're enjoying everything. And they tell me, oh, I was here back when you first opened. And I apologize immediately because I knew that the challenges that I was facing was definitely impacting the guest experience. So I'm proud of where we are now and where I am as a chef to say that I think that we are hitting strides with what the kosher community is looking for. And I think we're kind of breaking some boundaries here and challenging everybody that comes in to try different things. And surprisingly enough, they're enjoying it very much.
What was one of the dishes that presented the biggest challenge in making it kosher?
Oh, well, our menu has changed 3 times since then. I would have to say it was the flatbreads. So we're known for having meat flatbreads here. They've been on our menu since we've opened. We actually have 3. Out of those 3, 2 of them are from the opening menu. I would say that was the most challenging, with not being able to put dairy, you know, cheese, on a pizza, on a flatbread. That is something that's very traditional. That's something that I've done before. We've done flatbreads with smoked Gouda. We've done flatbreads with fresh mozzarella. I mean, ricotta cheese, you know. And it would incorporate meat, whether it was chicken or beef, you know, a steak or something like that on pizza. So that was probably the most challenging one because that was something the owners were very adamant about having. They wanted flatbreads because nobody else had really good meat flatbreads, and they wanted us to be the place that people come to. And, you know, we just found different ways. You know, our tartufo is a truffle spread with exotic mushrooms and a sunny-side-up egg baked right into it. Adding that sunny-side-up egg gives that richness, that creamy texture that cheese would usually add to a pizza. And so adding that component, I think, is where we were able to overcome that challenge of not having cheese available. So, and I'm not a fan of the non-dairy cheeses. I just don't find them to be texturally appeasing, and I almost don't want to insult the community by giving them fake cheese, because it's not that you can't have real cheese, you just can't have it in my restaurant. And so I wouldn't want to give you something that I felt was subpar. So that is, you know, a lot of the reason why we never even moved to having soy-based cheese or anything like that.
I can understand that. And while I have never tasted the meat with cheese, in defense and to argue with what you just said, granted, I don't have any yardstick to compare it with. However, I have tried some soy-based cheeses on hamburger for a non-dairy meat version, rather for a fully meat version of a cheeseburger, and I found it quite interesting. Would it taste the same as the other one, as the real thing? I have no way of knowing. However, it was appealing.
Yeah, that's something then. That means you have a product that I probably have not had, and that's where we need to collaborate a little bit. So next time you come in, maybe we'll have to bring some in so we can try it together, because I would be interested to see, and I would be interested to get your take
okay.
on that.
All right. Very good. Now, over the years, I am sure that you've had some interesting, whether funny, whether inspiring, whether something insightful that happened to you that changed the way you looked at things, that may have inspired you to do things differently. Can you tell us about such?
Sure. So I have two, but they're kind of tied to the same person. So the first one is definitely my grandmother was really an inspiration and really drove me to pursue this career. We would watch Hell's Kitchen together every week. She would record it for me because I always worked at night, and we would watch it the next day before I'd go back out to work. And, you know, have you ever watched Hell's Kitchen before?
Hello?
Hi. Yes?
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Hello?
Have you ever watched Hell's Kitchen?
Go ahead.
Have you ever watched Hell's Kitchen before?
Absolutely.
So you
absolutely
know,
I'd hate to work
about
in a place like that.
So you know all about Gordon Ramsay and his screaming and ranting and
berating.
Yes. Okay, perfect. So we watched that together, and every day she would tell me, oh, you would do great on that show. She's like, if you ever went on there, like, I would have a hard time letting him yell at you like that. She's like, I'd have to go there and let him know that he can't yell at my granddaughter. And she would get all angry at him, and she just had such a hard time understanding how some of the people got on the show, that they didn't have a lot of skill. And so we would watch that religiously for a long time. And it was very entertaining. However, my grandmother fell ill in January of 2012 and unfortunately passed away. And it was a very sad time. However, that was probably a really good turning point in my career, because I had stumbled across that Hell's Kitchen was looking for some candidates to come out and try. And so in honor of my grandmother, I said, you know what, I'm going to go and I'm going to try, because what do I have to lose? And something that she always instilled in me was to learn your self-worth. And so I figured, well, what would be better if I went on Gordon Ramsay's show, Hell's Kitchen, and put myself in a position to be screamed at, berated, food thrown, for however long I was there. And I said, yeah, this is exactly what I want to do. So I went, 6 o'clock in the morning, the interviews were starting at 9, and I was thinking, this is going to be like American Idol. There's going to be 500 people lined up around the block. Hopefully they'll see me today before I have to go to work. And I was number 13, which would turn out to be a very lucky number. I wound up being picked and wound up being on season 11 of Hell's Kitchen, and had an amazing time. Enjoyed it, loved it. I dedicated that whole season, my whole experience and my performance, you know, in my grandmother's memory. And I left that show knowing exactly what my self-worth was. And that, from there, is where I was able to catapult myself into becoming an executive chef, learning. I had finished my degree at Drexel University. I got a bachelor's in hotel and restaurant management. And I learned how to be a chef that doesn't just throw things across the kitchen and doesn't scream at the staff and doesn't berate them, but learned how to be a mentor and a teacher, because at the end of the day, even as being an executive chef, you're constantly teaching your team how to better themselves, how to improve their cooking, how to make the guest experience better. So it was definitely twofold. It was watching the show with my grandmother and then participating in the show in her honor, in her memory.
A friend of mine who now owns a kosher restaurant had a similar experience, except that he wasn't just on a show. He actually worked at Daniel Boulud's Bistro Moderne, and he says that more than once everybody in the kitchen wanted to kill the guy, he says he actually really learned how to cook much better from him than he ever learned in school.
Yes, I agree with that. So if you count my high school career, which was 4 years, and then 2 years at Johnson & Wales, 6 years total of training in an educational setting for culinary, I learned more from Gordon Ramsay in the 6 weeks that I spent with him than the 6 years of schooling. Now, that's, we're talking potatoes, potatoes. I'm learning from a Michelin-starred chef who has multiple restaurants around the world, and has multiple TV shows, and is such a personality, and such an amazing teacher. And that's a lot of what I took from him, other than just cooking techniques, was just the way he taught you. He came into the kitchen, everybody was at attention, we were watching, and he would go through, this is a new dish we're doing tonight, it's a special, and this is how you do it. And his just finesse, his demeanor, the way that he treated the food, the way that he cooked the food, everything was just done with such grace and such precision. That really is what, like, motivated me to perform well, you know, watching him step by step and memorizing exactly what he's doing. I mean, he showed you once and that was it. If you didn't learn it, he was going to let you know later on through dinner service that you, you know, messed up his entire dish, and how could you? In not such nice words, I'm, you know, editing this for the radio here, but he, you know, he treated us in the way that we were meant to be treated. A lot of people ask me, is Gordon Ramsay really as mean as he is on TV? And the answer is yes, he is really that mean, unless he's telling you that you're doing your job. The reason why he's so mean is because there's executive chefs, sous chefs, people that are chef owners, people that are line cooks, people that are still in culinary school that go on the show and they boast about how great they are. And then you put them in the kitchen and they work one station, not everything. They're not being Gordon Ramsay and running an entire kitchen, a whole brigade, and doing dinner service for 150 people. We work one station and then you can't perform. And, I mean, it could be as simple as dressing a Caesar salad. It's either too much dressing, too little dressing. And watching people that were executive chefs for 15, 20 years crack under pressure, they get yelled at because they deserve it, you know. However, Gordon Ramsay is a great guy. I loved working with him. I would have loved to continue working with him, but then I wouldn't have been blessed with the opportunity to be the executive chef at Bison and Bourbon. I would probably be in Las Vegas, roasting in the dry heat, probably spending all my money gambling instead of being here.
Ouch.
Instead of being here back in New York, which has always been my dream. I moved out of New York at a young age to New Jersey with my family, and I always wanted to come back here and be on the big stage and be an executive chef. And it's very amazing to say that I was able to achieve that at such a young age. I'm so happy.
Now, you've mentioned the kitchen brigade. Could you explain to our audience how the kitchen brigade is modeled after a military model, and who was the first one who came up with that?
So the kitchen brigade, I'm almost positive, was by Escoffier. I'm almost positive. We're testing my knowledge now.
No, you're right. It was Escoffier.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That was my knowledge from 12 years ago. but Escoffier came up with the kitchen brigade. So the kitchen brigade is basically each line cook, each chef is responsible for a certain station. And that could be you're only going to cook the meat. And then the next person is only cooking the seafood. Then there's somebody who's only cooking garnishes. There's somebody who's only cooking you know, cold appetizers. There's somebody only doing hot appetizers. There's one person only doing desserts. And so everybody is responsible for something. And the reason why this mirrors like the military is because without one person performing at 100%, the entire brigade slows down. So everybody's job is equally as important than the other. It is on the cold station making salads is not as important as the guy making mistakes. Well, they are, because they control the pace. Understand that they're not, you know, cooking off a ribeye or a filet or a rack of lamb and making sure that it's perfect medium rare or medium or well done. But the person that's on that cold salad station is controlling the pace for the entire kitchen. If they, for 1 second, skip a beat or miss a salad or take too long, then it slows down the entire production. So now that meat guy who knows my rack of lamb going medium rare always takes 12 minutes at 425 degrees. And so as soon as I'm ready to go in, you know, 18 minutes so that it rests for a couple of minutes and then I can slice it and bring it to the chef and the chef can then plate it. Well, if that salad guy skipped a beat, that's now rack of lamb is either going to overcook or it's going to be too cold, or you're going to wind up flashing in the oven and you're going to lose that beautiful medium rare look to it. And it's just the same with the dishwashers. There's two important positions in a restaurant. It is the host and it is the dishwasher. The host controls the pace. Otherwise, if they overseat somebody, then they, you know, that server gets backed up. If the server gets backed up, then the bar gets backed up because now the bar is handling more orders than they would. And it's a snowball effect. If the dishwasher is backed up, then you've run out of plates, you run out of glasses, and then your restaurant is not being ready for the next round of guests around dinner service. So the brigade is exactly the same way. And you could argue a guy who makes garnishes, I mean, they're sautéing mushrooms, they're sautéing potatoes, they're whipping grits. Of course, but if the garnishes don't make it to the chef before the proteins make it to the chef, then that means the chef is now going to have the meat or the seafood sitting there getting cold, overcooking, over resting while still waiting on the garnishes, because sometimes the potato puree needs to be on the bottom, then the steak is sliced and laid out neatly, then it's garnished and dressed with a sauce. That potato puree isn't there. Now the guest is going to get a lukewarm steak because they're waiting. And so it has to be a well-oiled machine. Has to be that way. It has to be running on all cylinders throughout the entire service. I like the movie Burnt. Have you watched that with Bradley Cooper?
Yes. Yes.
That's an amazing representation of a brigade and how a Gordon Ramsay restaurant runs. That is exactly the type of way that those restaurants operate. And that was an amazing movie. That was by far the best chef movie that I've ever seen.
Now, one more question. Talking about
Sure. The
restaurant. Unfortunately, not everybody who listens to the show has been to Bison and Bourbon yet. So let's try to describe a little bit what the restaurant looks like, and then let's talk about the signature dishes of the restaurant.
Okay. So, Bison and Bourbon is located in Gowanus, which is a little bit outside of Park Slope. And so we're in a little bit of a industrial area. So it's basically, the restaurant is a refurbished warehouse. So one of our owners actually built this restaurant by himself with his bare hands and, you know, a couple of people. Bison and Bourbon, you're immediately feel like you're not in Brooklyn anymore. Like you're not in an industrial area with other warehouses and busy trucks and deliveries. You walk into a beautiful courtyard that has three large windows on the left that look into the kitchen. You're able to see the pastry chef if you're here in the morning, or you're able to see the line cook that's making flatbreads and the saute cook, and you're able to watch our grill guy and our sous chef in the main window. And then last window, you're able to see all of the desserts and cold appetizers coming from our pantry station. So it's quite an effect in kosher. As Chaim was saying in the beginning, we are unlike any other kosher restaurant. A lot of it is due to the fact we have three very large windows. You can see what we're doing all night long. However, the garden on the other side is kind of set up to look like a village, like you're in a Mediterranean village somewhere far, far away from Brooklyn and all the craziness of Manhattan. And they have windows and lights and beautiful trees and nice greenery and flowers. One of our owners is very proud of the garden that we have every spring and summer. We must water it very early in the morning, and sometimes he'll do that himself because he takes such great pride in it. There is a lot of arrays of different tables, and we have a bar that has about 10 to 12 seats also that are outside. So we have guests that enjoy the service at the bar while enjoying, let's say, Monday Night Football tonight, which the Giants are playing. And you can sit outside and enjoy the gorgeous weather that we're having right now while, you know, eating at our restaurant, which a lot of, I don't believe any other kosher restaurant that I've been to here in Brooklyn or Manhattan has. You're then able to walk into our restaurant, which is, once you walk in, it's a multi-level restaurant. Our main floor contains some high tops and low top tables. This is where we usually have a lot of our larger parties. We have a lot of people that come here for their birthdays or engagement parties, and so we accommodate them there. And then on our second level, we have two separate mezzanines that overlook the main floor. So it's kind of a nice selling point to sit upstairs and kind of watch the busyness of the restaurant. We get a lot of people that ask to sit up there and against the rail so that they can watch everything that's happening. They get a great shot of the bar and of the main floor. Unfortunately, from up there, it's very difficult to see the kitchen, but it has its own advantage of sitting up there. Bison and Bourbon total is about 300 seats when you include our outside restaurant, kosher restaurant in Brooklyn. I'm not sure about Manhattan, but I definitely know in Brooklyn we have the largest space. And it makes it really convenient to do events here because our mezzanine is kind of sectioned off where you can have it private upstairs. And we also do other types of events, large parties and weddings and things like that. So we kind of have become a special occasion place, but we do have our wonderful regulars that come in two or three times a week to enjoy the atmosphere, the service. The cocktail program here is incredible. And of course, the food. They always are coming back to the food.
I remember the first time that I drove up to the restaurant. The, as you said, it's an industrial area, not exactly the nicest looking area. So I was wondering, gee, am I going to the right place? I mean, does all the hype make any sense, or is it just paid hype? The area did not look very inviting until I got to the restaurant and suddenly felt like I was transported to another dimension. Not only was the place beautiful and welcoming, but what is it doing in the middle of this area? And then, of course, I tasted the food. That's it. Mm-hmm. I was sold. Now, tell us something about your signature dishes and give us a little description, if possible.
Sure. So we have three signature dishes that are on our menu. We have first our bourbon barbecue pulled beef flatbread. That's one of the flatbreads that have been on our menu since we opened. And it is a bourbon barbecue sauce that we make here in-house. We slow cook it for about 6 to 8 hours so that it can rich the flavors without burning any of the sugars and not giving you that aftertaste. And then so we have that on the bottom. And the dough is hand-stretched, and we make the dough fresh here every day in-house. I have an amazing, talented baker who bakes all the breads every day. He does a wonderful job. So the base is the bourbon barbecue sauce. And then we have brisket that we slow cook for about 4 hours and then shred it down. And that's the meat that we use as the pulled beef Then we have a little bit of red onion, thinly sliced, just to kind of add a little bit of bite. It goes on raw, but as it is in the oven, it kind of cooks and softens a little bit, but it still gives that, like, nice bitiness of a red onion, but not too pungent-y where you think that you, wow, I just ate a whole red onion. Once it comes out of the oven, we brush it down with a little bit of seasoned olive oil with some herbs and garlic, salt, pepper, just to kind of give it a little shine on the crust. And we top it off with a little bit more of the bourbon barbecue and then micro cilantro. I love that combination of the barbecue, the beef, the onion, and then the cilantro. It just adds, like, the cilantro just adds a great freshness to it. And I'm a huge fan of cilantro or parsley. And so I chose cilantro because it reminded me of a dish that I did when I was in college working. I worked for a pizza place, and we used to do something similar, but we used chicken, and we used like a different style barbecue sauce, like a southern barbecue sauce, which is really more vinegar-based and has like mustard in it. And it used smoked Gouda, and so the brisket here has such a great flavor. We sear it really hard. We slow cook it for 6 hours. And so it has just like a nice richness to it that kind of helps substitute that smokiness that I had been missing. But it's such a great combination of flavors. And that is our number one selling appetizer in the restaurant is French fries, which is by far it was a very big shocker to me when I first started. But number two is our bourbon pulled beef flatbread. So that is a must. If you have not been to Bison and Bourbon yet, you must have that. It is always on the menu. It's in a little box. We have a couple boxes on the menu that denote what our signature items are. Our next signature item is also something that's been on the menu since day one. It is our tuna tartare. And we make our own sweet chili sauce here. We don't buy one that's pre-made. We make our own sweet chili sauce, and then we use a little bit of soy, shallot, garlic, and cucumber. And we marinate the tuna. We cut the tuna fresh every day, and we marinate it every day. And a little bit of salt to kind of finish in there. We let that sit at least 1 hour before serving it to the guests so that it gets some flavor throughout it. And we serve it with an avocado mousse and some crostinis. And it is, wow, it is incredible. That is a great alternative if you come to our restaurant and you're not interested in having meat, which, of course, we want to be able to have really flavorful fish options. And so the tuna tartare is perfect for that. It's very refreshing. It's light. And a lot of people get it to share at the table because it's a little bit of a big portion. We kind of have – our options here are not meant to be small and expensive. We want everything to kind of be a little bit robust and kind of fit our theme, our atmosphere. You know, we have a multi-level restaurant with high vaulted ceilings, you know, exposed wood and brick and stone floors. So the food, we want to kind of be the same way. We don't want it to be small, petite, fine dining. We want it to feel that rustic atmosphere that we've created with the restaurant. So the dish is very nice and is easily shareable for two people, especially if they're looking to taste a lot of our appetizers. And then I would say our third signature item is on our mains. It's our Applewood Smoked Delmonico. Now, we've always had an Applewood Smoked Delmonico, which is a ribeye cut. Basically, we clean the fat all off of it so that it's the leanest cut on the menu. But we still have good marbleization throughout. Our process in smoking it is that we take the entire rib and leave all the fat on because fat adds flavor, especially when you're cooking or smoking. You want to leave that there. So we take them and we take applewood chips. We soak them so when you light them, they have a lot of smoke coming out of it. When you soak wood chips in water, it just creates a lot more smoke and flavorful smoke, not like your backyard fire. So we smoke it on a cold smoke. And what that means is that we don't turn the heat on for our smoker. We just have the chips smoking. And that allows us to not cook the ribeye. We don't cook the rib. We're just smoking it. And we smoke it for about a half hour. A really intense smoke, 30 minutes, and then we take it out. So the temperature never exceeds 80 degrees. You're never going to cook the meat, and that allows us to still get very rare steaks out of it because we, you know, of course, have guests that would like all the temperatures that we're able to offer. And so we cold smoke it, and it's an interesting technique. It's very different from when you smoke your brisket for 8 hours and you keep it at less, you know, about 200 degrees or less than that. You don't want it to cook at all, but you still want to be able to get a lot of that flavor. So, and then our grill guy, when he comes in, he cleans all the fat off of it from there. Some of that fat kind of melts and drips onto the meat and kind of helps retain some of that moisture in case for some reason the chips get a little bit too hot and raise the temperature in our smoker. But he trims a lot of that off, again, to allow for the leanest cut of our steak. And then we have those. And so the Delmonico has been on our menu, but always in a different fashion because we change our menu seasonally. We try to change it twice a year for seasonality. We have a spring-summer menu, and then we have a fall-winter menu. So the steak is always there, but the options, the side items change on it. And we like doing that with the Delmonico specifically because it is a signature item and people come because the steak is really good. And so we want to make sure that we keep the guests interested. We don't want them to come in and always get the same steak with the same size and the same sauce. We want to be able to offer them their favorite steak, but with a twist each and every season if possible.
Very good.
And we're just about out of time. I want to thank you, Chef Cindy. You've been a very, very interesting guest. Of course, there was one drawback to this conversation. You made my mouth water during the last 35 minutes. I guess I have no choice but to go back to the restaurant now. Otherwise, I'm like a junkie in search of a fix.
Well, next time you come in, you got to bring me some of that soy cheese so we can work that out.
I absolutely will. Okay. Thank you very much, Chef. Good night.
My pleasure was all mine.
And good night, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening in. We'll be back after the Hagim, after the holidays. A happy, healthy, and prosperous new year. A good Gebenstior. Tiva vechatima tova to one and all. Good night.
Good night.